Thanks for joining us here on Service to School Stories. Your hosts for this season are Alec Emmert, Service to School CEO and Navy veteran.
And Sydney Mathis, Chief Program Officer and former College Admissions Officer. This season, we'll cover topics as it relates to higher education, military service transition, and career opportunities and outcomes for veterans. Join us as we share student stories, inside tips from the admissions office, and conversations with employers actively hiring student veterans. Here we go.
Welcome, everyone, to the Service to School Stories podcast. Today's episode, I'm really excited about. It's a chance for me to deep dive with one of my incredible colleagues into the world of veterans and college admissions. So today we are joined by Annie Bahari. She is the Director of Student Success. Annie is a wealth of information, and all of our applicants who have the chance to work with Annie are in incredible hands. So really excited to have you on the podcast, Annie, and a chance for us to chat a little bit about the work that you do and veterans who are pursuing higher education. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I'm so excited to be here. This is my first podcast ever. Hi, everyone. My name is Annie. I am, like Sydney said, the Director of Student Success here. I started off in higher education with, I did my undergraduate at Boston University and then my graduate program at Harvard and in higher education. And then I started to work in admissions, like so many people who study higher education. I worked at a small liberal arts college in northeastern Pennsylvania called Lafayette. It is actually the smallest Division I school in the country, which is a little known fact about Lafayette. And then I worked at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. And that was really interesting to work at a, you know, super selective school that also, you know, recruited so widely, you know, across the world. So I did that for a few years, and then I switched to the college counseling side. I worked at a private school in Florida for a little bit, and then you and I met at CollegeWise, which is a independent college counseling firm. And then I came over here to Service to School to use my knowledge for better.
Yeah. I stole you and was like, hey, we're hiring someone. I know just the person that is great. So today, Annie and I have kind of been compiling questions, myths that we have heard. So one of our jobs here at Service to School is to chat with everyone who signs up for undergraduate support and wants to work with one of our ambassadors. So they'll have an initial conversation with one of our staff members, Annie, myself, Whitney, or Alex Nieves. And we kind of talk with applicants through their questions, their initial questions, and tell them a little bit about the program. So Annie and I, in preparation for the conversation today, started a list of the most common questions, myths, concerns that we hear from you all as prospective students pursuing college admissions. So Annie, we're going to deep dive into, or I like to call it sometimes a snorkel when you're kind of skimming on the surface a little bit more. But let's go ahead and start with one of the most common questions that we get is, I heard veterans have a higher chance of getting into an Ivy League college. Is that true?
That's a really good question. And it's something that we hear all the time. The answer is not necessarily, not really. There's not one population that is more highly desired than another. Colleges always aim to admit a well-rounded student body. So they do want representation from all manners of people, but it's not true that like veterans get in easier or that they're you know, trying to recruit veterans in a so that they can enroll more veterans. I mean, obviously recruitment, they are trying to recruit veterans, but not necessarily, you know, to fill a certain number of seats or anything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I always remind students is, yes, you know, we talk about, I mean, institutional priorities, right? And for our listeners, institutional priorities are the institutions deciding, you know, okay, we want a student from all 50 states and territories, you know, like that is an institutional priority for them. And for especially a lot of our partner schools, getting more diverse student perspective and viewpoints on their campus is an institutional priority. One way they can do that is through veterans. But also, I think I don't want to take away from any of the successes of our applicants that get into, you know, Ivy League schools, because they've done the work, they've prepped, they've worked with Service to School. And, you know, to say it's easier kind of minimizes their academic successes too. So I always try and point that out also, that our applicants that are getting into these schools deserve to be there. They have done the work in the classroom and they presented themselves, you know, in an incredible application packet to schools like Harvard, Princeton, and Yale.
Oh, absolutely. And I think along with that idea is that you're not admitted by mistake, right? So they're not just trying to fill, you know, however many seats they have with veterans. No, they're looking for applicants who are thoughtful, who are the right fit for their institutions. And like you said, have done the work to prove that. So it's not as though like you submit an application and then, you know, you've thrown your hat in the ring. There is a lot of work that should go into your application to kind of get you to where you want to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And you kind of mentioned this a little bit. So we've had students say all the time, I think there's some thread on Reddit that says they heard there's a set number of seats for veterans at insert name of school here. From your work in admissions, how do you answer that question?
There isn't. The process of admitting and enrolling a class is so challenging that there is not a set of seats for anybody. There are a lot of different moving parts. And one application is comprised of like so many different pieces. So for example, you know, you might have a male veteran who also is from a particular part of the country who had this kind of experience in the military. So there aren't, that person might fill several boxes. So it's not like it's not a static picture. There's not just one seat. So that's part of why admitting students to a school is a moving target. Right. So there aren't that many seats it's not that there aren't spots. It's more like, do you fit kind of the mold or the shape that they're looking for? And if you do, they will admit you. Right. But if you don't, then they won't. So it's a moving target.
Yeah. I remember telling students, you know, when I was reading applications for George Washington University, if I wanted to admit every single student that applied from one high school, I could. You know, it's not that I'm only allowed to admit 5 students from Scarsdale High School in upstate New York, right? No, if they're all qualified, if I think they are all candidates that would, you know, contribute to our campus community, I can admit all 5.
Right.
If I want, right? And the reverse of that, I can deny all of them, you know, if I don't feel like they are a good fit. So even though the school might have 10 spots or they're looking to enroll 10 student veterans, if they don't get 10 qualified student veterans, they're not going to admit 10 student veterans, right? Just to fill a, you know, unsaid quota. To your point, that's not how admissions work. Sure, they have a set number of incoming spots for the entire student class, right? Because we see it all the time when they're talking about housing shortages or you want to keep smaller class sizes, right? Like, sure, they can't admit every single person that applies because of that, but to say that, oh, well, 15 veterans applied and I was number 21 of the application submitted, like, that's not how admissions works at the end of the day.
Correct. And that's a part of what makes holistic admissions what it is. So there aren't just a number of seats for populations, but also what you're bringing to the table is really important to them. And that's why they look at the entire application. So, right, you're not just number 21 veteran out of, you know, 20 spots. You're also, as I said, like you bring all these different characteristics and traits and goals. That's a part of what colleges are trying to get at when they ask you about, when they ask you to complete their applications.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the student who says, I have a low high school GPA, but then served in the military. Can I still get into a good college?
Yes, you can. This is one of the best parts, I think, about being an adult applicant to colleges and universities. They understand that there's so much growth that happens after high school. So when you're a high school student, you get to have that growth at the college, right? If you've graduated and you've gone right onto college, a part of going to college is developing and growing. And when you're an adult student or a veteran and you're ready to come to start studying at a school, like they know that you've lived a whole life before this, especially if you've been in the military. So yeah, colleges, I generally tell applicants that the farther away from high school you are, the less it kind of matters. Now, they will still want to know about your academic ability. And I think we'll talk about some ways that you can demonstrate that if you've been out of high school for a little while. But even if you did poorly in high school and you feel like you're ready coming out of the military to start at a school, it really doesn't matter. They know that you've grown and changed since high school.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about the part of that question, Annie, where it says, would I be able to get into a good school? Like what? Let's talk about a good school.
Right. So what is a good school? This is something that I feel our applicants sometimes struggle with, because when people think of good schools, I think we all might think of like the same 25 schools, right? But it's really subjective. What is a good school? A good school for one person might not be a good school for another. And it really depends on what you want to study, what your long-term goals are. Some schools are better at sending applicants onto graduate school. And if that's your ultimate goal, that might be the place for you. But if you're looking to graduate and go right into a workforce, well, then that's different. So instead of using a measure like good, we always encourage our applicants to think about what they want in an institution and what that school offers. Again, that's a part of finding like the right fit for you. How do you kind of marry those two ideas so that you're finding the right or a good school for you?
Yeah. And I love using the analogy, and I've probably mentioned this on a podcast before, of like car shopping, right? What is a good car for me with two children, two dogs, you know, like mostly local driving is very different from my mom, who is single, you know, doesn't drive much, you know, she might need a smaller car than I do, right? Like the needs and fits of, you know, our daily driver are going to look very different. But also you mentioned something there, right? Like what is the intended outcome? And the example I love to use here is going to the gym, right? We can all get a gym membership. We can all go to college. But if I just walk through the gym, walk around, I don't do too much, my outcome is going to be very different from the person who's killing it on the bike. They're going to all the classes, right? Like they're working with a personal trainer. Our outcome is going to look very, very different, right? So it's also like, to your point, what is the intended outcome? Is it just to get a degree? Because we can find a good school for you to just get that piece of paper.
Right.
But if it is truly to prepare yourself for, you know, your next step, either graduate school or the workforce, there's probably a better school that's suited for that intended outcome.
Absolutely. And sometimes when we talk to applicants, we have that conversation of like, I've spoken to applicants who are like, yeah, I know I can get a job in this field. I just need the paper to prove it. Well, then do we have to do the work of you know, applying to the most selective schools in the country if the goal is I need the credential and then I have a plan afterwards? So it totally depends on the person.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you say to the applicant that says they want to apply to every Ivy?
Oh my gosh, do you want to do all of that work? That's what I say to that applicant. Those applications are difficult because those schools are hard to get into. And we mentioned holistic admissions. We mentioned, you know, the idea of finding the right fit. All of that's kind of related into the app. It's all built into the application. This is how you're evaluated. So when you're applying to a school, you know, like Harvard or Princeton, these are not applications that you can just kind of, you know, or that you shouldn't just throw, you know, 5 minutes of work into. These are applications that require thought and time and preparation. So we are so supportive of applicants who want to apply, you know, to really difficult and difficult schools to get into, schools that are going to prepare them well, schools that are rigorous. But we also want them to be realistic about how much time do you have to devote to this, because it really requires work.
Yeah. I can't tell you, it's almost like every admission cycle, someone is like, I just didn't realize how many essays I'd have to write.
Right.
Like, yeah, you're losing steam now as we get closer to these deadlines, right? We want to submit quality applications, not quantity of applications, right? Like that is not going to increase your odds of being admitted. Like you said, just like, you know, putting an essay together last minute. We talk to applicants about, you know, this is not a lotto. It's not like the Ivy League lotto, right? Like, you aren't buying one lotto ticket and it's going to, you know, 8 potential jackpots, right? No, you are literally submitting a ticket to 8 different jackpots and hoping, you know, sometimes it can feel like the lotto too, like hoping that your Powerball gets pulled. So it's that thoughtfulness that comes out in those essays, you know, that like really stands out. I can remember essays that stood out to me now, you know, like years after reading college admissions, applications and admissions. So, how do you help students think through, you know, when they say, I want to apply to all 8 Ivies, and I'm like, the Ivies themselves are different too.
Right. That's also so significant. And it's a part of why we encourage applicants to think through their college lists almost before they do anything else. Because like you said, they're so different. So if you want to go to Brown or you want to apply to Brown and you want to apply to the University of Pennsylvania, they're like they're totally, totally different schools. Yeah. Brown has, you know, the open curriculum, and Penn is really well known for being sort of a pre-professional environment. We have applicants who want to apply to Columbia and Cornell. I mean, they're both in New York State, and that's as similar as they get, right? One is fairly rural, and the other is in the middle of a bustling
massive city.
So, yes. Right. So we always encourage applicants to think first, like, what are you looking for truly? You know, what environment do you want to be in? Are you thinking about where you want to live? What about the cost of living? What kind of access to things do you want or need? So that should really be driving where you want to apply. And sure, that list might mean that you apply to Columbia and Penn and some other cities, other application colleges that are in cities, but it would make me question, like, why do you have Cornell on this list? Or, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that leads into my next point. Like, I think once a week, one of us is saying, like, so the applicant sounds like they're just trophy chasing.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of that comes out, especially when we start working on essays with them, you know, and maybe if the school is asking, like, why is insert name of school the best place for you to continue your academics, right? You know, if you can't answer that question very clearly and you're struggling to come up with an answer, maybe you haven't been thoughtful enough right. in figuring out why that school is on your list.
Right. And if it's hard for you to write, the colleges can tell. Like if you're struggling to connect, you know, again, what you're looking for and what that school offers in a thoughtful way, they know that. And those are things that can work against you. Honestly, sometimes more than the first review of an application starts with the academics, right? So if you've cleared the bar and you've made it to the next round and you're academically qualified, and then they start to read those essays, well, an essay like that that isn't doing the job of clearly stating why you want to be there, and because it's because you don't know why you want to be there exactly, that's a reason that a college probably won't admit you. And it's mm-hmm. probably, it seems like a harsh thing, but there, like you said, there's so many more qualified applicants than there are seats.
That's a great candidate for the wait list.
Right. Right. And you don't want to be on the wait list. And
you don't want to be on the wait list. That's not our end goal.
You don't. And then colleges don't, I mean, they love a wait list because it means that they can kind of leave you hanging in the wind and call you up if they need you. But it's not a place you want to be.
No, absolutely not. Another thing we hear often is applicants who are concerned that colleges know that they are applying to their peers, right? So if you're applying to Yale and Princeton, how is that perceived?
That's an interesting question, because how would the colleges know? They wouldn't know unless you told them, and you wouldn't tell them, obviously. So there used to be a question on the Common App that asked that, you know, where else are you applying? And that's no longer a question. You don't have to share where you're applying to anyone. And trust me, they know, you know. So when I worked at Johns Hopkins, we knew that applicants were applying to the Ivies and you know, other super selective schools. And we also knew that if they were admitted off the wait list at those schools, they were turning down their spot at Hopkins. Yeah.
Oh, we played that game regularly when I was at GW, because we're Georgetown, GW, American, and Catholic, right? Like, blocks all within the DC area. And you knew once admissions decisions rolled out, it was like, well, we admitted that student, but they got into Georgetown, or, you know, we waitlisted that student, but they just got pulled off of a waitlist somewhere else. And it's just like, they know, right? But it doesn't matter. I'm not necessarily denying a student because I'm like, oh, well, they'll probably get into Georgetown. So I'm just going to go ahead and, you know, take them off my list.
Exactly. No, that is not what happens at all. Even though the colleges will understand, like, yeah, this perfect 4.0 student, you know, who's had all these really incredible experiences and is really has written really well and thoughtfully, and they're not going to deny you because they think that you're going to be admitted somewhere else. That's not how it works. And that's, again, a part of like the holistic admissions piece, that if you're the right fit for the school, and you've expressed that, then, you know, they want you on their campus.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're willing to fight for you too sometimes when it comes to things like financial aid. And that's why enrolling students is a moving target.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about students that think they have to go to an Ivy if they're going to go on and have a successful career or pursue graduate school at a top graduate program. Like, I've heard students so many times, well, I want to go to, you know, Yale Law School, so I have to go to Yale undergrad. How do you kind of work through that situation?
That's not true, I mean, at all. Again, when colleges or universities are admitting at the graduate level, they're looking at the same things, right? They want a diversity of experiences. They don't want to admit, Yale Law doesn't want to admit a ton of students from Yale. What kind of, like, that would be a very boring class to be a part of. So again, they're looking for a diversity of experiences, even at the graduate level. And when you're, when you know that you want to go to graduate school, you do have to think about how will you do academically at your undergraduate. I used to work with a lot of pre-med applicants, and I'd always tell them, you know, if you want to go to medical school, the number one thing is you have to think about your GPA. Where will you go that you will have an opportunity to do well academically, get the support services that you need, get the pre-med services that you need to be prepared for medical school? That's the thing that should be driving your decision. So you shouldn't be trying to go to like the most competitive school simply because they're the most competitive. You should try to go to the school where you can get the most resources and do well academically in order to make it to medical school.
Yep. I remember at GW, our undergraduate students all the time used to say, it's harder for us as GW students to get into GW law. It's like, well, yeah, because they're not trying to duplicate the entire GW experience, you know, at the law school level now. But I have data points that I always share with students. So, I mean, you can Google a list of, you know, biggest companies and where the CEOs went. But CEO of Walmart got their BA from University of Arkansas with an MBA from University of Tulsa. Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, got his industrial engineering degree from Auburn, which Auburn has a great sleeper engineering school, by the way. And then got his MBA from Duke. So again, you don't necessarily have to go to, you know, tracking through those top schools to do well, you know, in the business world. And then pivoting to the law school piece, I tell students to Google this all the time. Harvard Law releases their list of incoming 1L, like they give a student profile, right? So they talk about test scores on the LSAT, they talk about GPA, they talk about demographics, but they also post a list of the undergraduate institutions that their 1L class came from. And I pulled some that most of our applicants have probably never heard of. So there's 147 undergraduate institutions represented in Harvard's incoming 1L class. Stevens Institute of Technology, which you and I have encouraged students to attend, Patrick Henry College, Gordon College, and then a shout out to my undergraduate alma mater, West Virginia University. So, you know, yes, Harvard Law was on there, Yale was on there, but schools that most of our applicants have probably never heard of or wouldn't consider, right, because they aren't the bumper sticker schools, or, you know, they don't have that same clout that others do. But it's all about what you do when you get there. Kind of going back to that gym analogy, right? Like, outcome's going to look a little bit different if you go to, you know, Harvard and maybe you don't do so great. I have an applicant who one time said, I am with the Olympians of computer science at my current school, and trying to find internships is really hard because everyone is so brilliant. Everyone is incredibly talented. you know, and it's like, well, you got your top choice school. That's where you really wanted to go. So that's great. But let's talk about, again, that outcome, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. Like you said, it's totally about what you do when you're there. And sometimes, again, if graduate school is on the horizon for you, sometimes it's better to be a big fish in a small pond. It's better to be at a school where you can kind of have more access and take advantage of things. I had a similar situation with an applicant who was admitted to both Emory and UCLA and for pre-med. And I mean, UCLA is a huge school. The opportunities for a pre-med are there, but it's a lot harder to get because it's a big school and there are a lot more students interested in those types of things. And Emory, when you think about Atlanta and the CDC being there and just having more access, it was a better fit for that reason. So we definitely encourage, you know, people to think about that. It's something that most people don't think about, I think.
Yeah, I love encouraging students to think about how geographic location benefits their college list outside of just wanting to be like somewhere warm or, you know, like close to family, but also looking at like, let's talk about career outcomes and where you can position yourself to be in a really great location to have access to like the CDC, to do hands-on research. You know, that's what med schools are looking for now, honestly, is like experience. Harvard actually, they posted too, the percentage of students in the incoming class that were 1, 2, and 3 years out from undergrad. Right. So they're looking for students that have some kind of world experience, you know, doing the work. So is there a school that can put you in a location to provide access to those? That to me is a better payoff than a name on a diploma that maybe hasn't served you so well. Right. So we've talked a lot about the myths that our applicants share with us. In the bit of time we have left together chatting, I know we could probably talk about this all day. Let's talk about ways applicants ask, how can I strengthen my applications?
Yeah. So if you've been out of high school for a little while, and you're applying to college now, one of the best ways to strengthen your application is to take a class at a community college or a local four-year school. Like I said before, the biggest kind of hurdle you have to jump when you're applying to schools as an adult is are you academically ready? And especially for the more selective schools, there are no like remedial classes. Like there's no way to catch up. I know at Hopkins, there is nothing below calculus. If you are not ready to take calculus when you come to campus, you cannot come to campus, and that's it. So the best thing for you to do is to take a class or two. Maybe that means enrolling for a year or getting your associates to demonstrate that you are capable of doing that work at that level. Oftentimes, we have applicants who come and are like, I want to study computer science, or I want to study mechanical engineering. And those types of areas of study require prep. They require, again, coursework, especially if you're going to apply to a selective school. So that's probably the best thing that you can do is kind of get back out there, show that you can do the work, and get back in the mindset, you know, of being a student.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I tell students all the time, a majority of our students have some type of credit, right? Like when we go and we look through our list of matriculants, or we look at, you know, where our students are enrolling, a majority of them are applying as a transfer student because they either have military credits, they've taken, you know, credits while they're on active duty using TA, or they transitioned off of active duty and went to a local community college or a four-year, and now they are, you know, taking that full 30 credits and transferring on to especially one of our partner institutions. So getting back into that academic mindset is so important, because if my job as an admissions officer is to make a decision on, can you be successful in my classroom? What's the best way to show me you can be successful in my classroom? To show me that you have, right?
Right.
What about the student who's saying, okay, well, should I take the SAT or the ACT to strengthen my application?
It's a really good question, because right now, many schools are still not requiring the ACT or the SAT. Many of them haven't required it since the start of the pandemic. This is a policy that can change. And I was just looking at the Harvard application, and they're very clear that like testing is required, but from now until 2026, we are not requiring testing. So I think you always have to be kind of ready that for that policy to change. If we have listeners, you know, listening from the like in the future, it's possible that that can change. But right now, many places don't require testing. If you feel like you can do well, and it's not going to be a burden to take it or study for it, take it. You know, I have some applicants who are like, yeah, I'm a good test taker, and they decide that they want to take it. That's fine. If it's going to be a burden to take, if you don't have the time, if you don't test well, don't bother. Don't let it stress you out. It's not required. We also, you know, often tell applicants if don't share your score with schools if you don't do well, right? Yeah. So if they're making many schools make it optional to share your score. If you share it, it should be good. It should fall within their middle 50, right? Don't give them a reason to deny you. So if it feels like this is not going to help my application, don't bother. Having said that, there are some schools that require it. MIT requires testing for both first year and transfer applicants. Purdue requires testing. So it really depends on your list of schools, but generally no, right?
Yeah, generally no.
Yeah.
And especially schools like University of California system, they are not even test optional. They are test free. So they will not accept test scores, even if you do well and want to send them. So that's one thing that we highlight in our college research tracker is what is the school's testing policy? I had an applicant sign up yesterday. She's planning on applying to schools in 2027.
Yeah.
I'm like, who knows? You know, I don't think we've seen too many policies that have gone that far out. And she's looking at computer science and engineering. So having, you know, testing on file there could be beneficial to her. Yeah. But the beautiful thing is she signed up now. So we get to have these conversations about, you know, you have time to prep, you have time to take classes, you have time to study and prepare. So definitely you don't want to show up to the SAT the day of and hope you're going to knock it out of the park. Some people can.
Right.
That's not me.
Yeah. I'm surprised at how many, I'm not surprised, maybe because I'm not a great test taker, but like I've spoken to applicants who are like, yeah, I can take a test. And I'm like, cool. You can do it if you'd like. Don't have to.
If you'd like.
Yeah.
Yeah. We run into all the time a question around letters of recommendation. How do you see or how do you navigate that conversation with our applicants?
It's hard because we know that so many of our applicants have not been in an academic environment or a formal academic environment. But we can't get around the fact that schools require letters of recommendation. And oftentimes the most important ones are the academic letters. And so if you're taking a class, right, like at a community college in between the time that you are starting at, you know, your four-year school, try to create those relationships with your community college professors. We have also a lot of applicants who are taking online classes, you know, through UMGC or Arizona State online. You can still create a relationship and ask for letters from those instructors as well. I know it's not as natural as, you know, you're going to class every day and seeing that person, but you should be making an effort to connect with someone who can speak to your academic ability. That is really important to schools. It's not something that they can, you know, kind of take your word for that you're, you know, an ACE student. They want to hear from someone else about what you're like in the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. And I encourage applicants all the time, you know, have a clear understanding of the number of letters of recommendation that the school is asking for.
Yeah.
If they are very specific that it needs to be an academic letter of recommendation, how many optional letters are they going to allow you? Understanding that those letters have to come directly from the recommender. The student should not be submitting letters of recommendation on their own. But I mean, I hear students all the time, oh, I took classes online and, you know, we never interacted with our instructors. I never even saw them. And to your point, it's like, okay, well, did they offer office hours? Did you at least try? And if you tried all of those things and they're still, you know, you're still coming up short, I encourage students to think all the time that learning can happen outside of the confines of four walls, you know, when a student or a teacher in front, you know, sharing information. The definition of learning is truly like taking in information, digesting it, and applying it to practice, right? And is there someone at work, a supervisor, that can speak to your ability to be a learner?
Right.
If, like, we are truly out of options and that's all we have left, right? I think it's worth explaining on an application, maybe in an additional information section. But don't let that be a reason you don't submit an application because you don't have a letter of recommendation.
Oh, absolutely. And I also tell applicants all the time, don't stress about it, because the one thing you don't want is a bad letter of recommendation, right? You just don't want any red flags. If it's the most standard, boring letter, and obviously, hopefully you will not have seen that letter in advance, but it doesn't need to be glowing. It doesn't need to be hyper specific. It just needs to recommend you, essentially. Right. So it's not something that the applicant should stress over.
Yeah. And especially who they ask, I think we get a lot of questions and concerns around. And I'm like, look, I don't know anything about military rank, right? Like, mm-hmm. I know basic information about our ranks, the branches. I'm not a veteran myself. So I am not reading a file and saying, oh, this person got the top person, you know, in their chain of command versus their direct supervisor, right? I would rather take the direct supervisor who knows you better than the top ranking official who probably doesn't know you that well and can speak generally about who you are, but maybe you asked them because you thought they had a flashy title. Like, right. Reading applications in DC, we saw Congress people and senators on letters of recommendation all the time. And I'm like, great. You told me that you really don't understand who this student is. And right. I didn't glean much additional information about, do I think they're a good fit in the classroom?
Right.
But the student thought, you know, that was the best letter recommendation to submit. And I, you know, have to politely disagree. Okay. As we wrap up, Annie, what is your last piece of advice to our listeners as they are, you know, in the weeds or pursuing, considering submitting applications in the near future?
It is so important to be well informed. There's so much information out there. And there are a lot of websites that have gathered the information for you. But you should do your best to understand the school's policies and your situation in particular. So if you're applying as a transfer, do you have enough credits to be considered a transfer? Some applicants, right, sometimes they're first year, sometimes they're transfers. And they're applying the same cycle, and it depends on the school's policies. You should go directly to the school for that. Feel free to ask questions of admissions officers and to email people, email professors. I mean, it sounds weird, but it's not. You know, I remember getting emails and questions all the time and referring students or prospective students to professors and departments, and they're there to help facilitate your education. And so we want you to make a well-informed decision. And a part of that is doing all of this research. And then the last thing, I know you asked for just one, but I just want to say that.
Let's hear more of it.
Be mindful of what's out there. You know, you mentioned Reddit. You know, I've seen all kinds of stuff. There are a lot of myths out there. People have one experience and they think that that's the case for everybody or for every institution, and it's not. So the best you can do is know your process and for your schools, and go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, for our listeners, if you all are not currently working with Service to School, would absolutely encourage you to sign up, because you get to work with individuals like Annie and myself who have read thousands of college admissions essays. We've worked with hundreds of students, you know, undergraduate, veterans, but also just traditional students. We've been doing this work for a really long time. So as much as we can support you all throughout this admissions process, that is 100% what we are here to do. And it is an absolute honor to be able to serve our student population. It is just such a joy to help veterans, you know, navigate this process, but also to share their story through their essays and through their admissions applications. So Annie, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and enlightening our listeners with just all of the amazing information that you have to share with our student population. This has been fun.
Yes, I love it. This is my first podcast, and I think I did really well.
You did great. You did great. So with that, everyone, thank you for listening this week, and we will see you next week on the Service to School Stories podcast. Take care.
That's all we have for this episode. Join us next week, same time, same place, where we share more Service to School stories. Service to School Stories is hosted by Sydney Mathis, Chief Program Officer, and Alec Emmert, Service to School CEO. Our podcast is produced and edited by our Director of Communication, Amanda Tobias. Service to School is a 501c3 nonprofit providing free college admission support to transitioning service members and veterans. Join us next week and follow us for more on your favorite social media platforms.